This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, and here are some of the stories NPR News is following this afternoon. Israeli missiles struck a Gaza compound, killing a senior Hamas figure. The attack follows a deadly bus bombing in Jerusalem earlier in the week. Hamas and Islamic Jihad have now declared the recent ceasefire over. The United States is asking for a new UN resolution calling on more countries to contribute to the military force in Iraq. Secretary of State Colin Powell was at the United Nations today. Details on those stories coming up later today on All Things Considered. Here on Talk of the Nation, we're discussing what motivates people to do relief work in some of the world's most dangerous places. Of course, you're invited to join the discussion. If you've done this kind of work, we'd like to know why and if your perspective has changed with age and experience. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. As we mentioned earlier, aid workers have increasingly become targets of violence. Many of those lost or injured in the bombing at the Canal Hotel in Baghdad worked for non-governmental aid organizations other than the UN. Gordy Molitor is the country director in Somalia and South Sudan for one such organization, CARE. And he joins us now from his home in Nairobi, Kenya. Welcome to Talk of the Nation. Hello, Mr. Molitor. Can you hear me? We are trying to reach Gordy Molitor, and we'll obviously lost the line to Nairobi, and we'll try to dial it back up. In the meantime, let's go to Dick, and Dick joins us on the line from Turlock, California.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
Pleased to be on your program.
Well, that's very nice. It's pleased
I
to
want
have
to
you.
Talk about I was able to be in Sarajevo in 1996 and again in 1997 to be a monitor of the elections. I wasn't actually in Sarajevo, I was in towns outside, but what made my trip, I guess, kind of unique was that I got to go on the Muslim side in 96, and then I was on the Serbian side in 97 and got to see both sides of the conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it was being able to see both sides that was an eye-opening experience for me as an American. I suppose people want to know what was the cause of that conflict, and a wise gentleman who was the election supervisor in the first town, Brezza, where I was the first time, said, you know, Americans, you lack a historical context. You want to say it's about land, or you want to say it's about religion, or you want to say it's about history. It's about all these things, but much more. He said, you can't possibly understand it in a context of a country as young as yours, but just go back and tell people what you've seen. It'll be enough. So since I've been back, I guess it's one of the things I try to do is talk about what I saw.
Yeah. I wonder, one of the things you were doing there was obviously monitoring elections. What do you think about democracy since you've come back?
Timely question as a Californian. I think it was a Churchill who said it's not the best system out there, but it's certainly way ahead of whatever's we may be in second place, but we're I got the quote wrong. We may not be the best, but we're way ahead of whatever's in second place.
It's something along those lines. Was it an experience? People have talked about, again, if you go to dangerous places, it's terrifying and it's thrilling at the same time.
Oh, absolutely. To be on the cutting edge and watching democracy be born was absolutely fascinating. The terrifying part was when we got into Sarajevo and we landed and the airport was entirely surrounded by troops. And they said, well, we're going to send you out to your places. We're going to give you these maps, and the areas that are known to be mine will be marked in pink. And then they handed me a pink map. And, you couldn't step off the pavement at any particular place. We were there for a month, and one of the things we kind of watched is where the shepherds put their sheep up the roads. And if the sheep flock came back with the same number in the afternoon, we figured, well, I guess we can walk up that road tomorrow. But it was, when we could hear gunfire at night, but in the mornings you'd go into the cafe and have breakfast, and you'd say to the driver, the translator, somebody, what was that gunfire about last night? What gunfire? Either to become a part of their background, or they didn't want to talk about it. I was never sure, but it was part of the reality of daily life.
Dick, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Okay, thanks.
And we do now have Gordy Molitor back on the line, the country director in Somalia and South Sudan for CARE, and he's with us from Nairobi, Kenya. Good of you to speak with us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Now, you work in Somalia and South Sudan, but you live in Nairobi. That's for security reasons?
Yes, it's for security and logistical reasons. Neither country has a government, and so we have our headquarters base of operations here, and then field offices in each of the countries.
How does an organization like CARE determine the relative danger of a place?
I think it's assessed individually or by country, and we do that with our through our local staff, through the local United Nations, and through other NGOs that are all on the ground in that country.
I assume you're all very careful.
Yes, we have to be. It's something that we do day to day. We assess daily. All of our senior management meetings, we start off with a discussion on security. It's something that we try to keep in the forefront of all of our staff's minds.
Now, you've been with CARE for 19 years. Have your feelings about your security and the security of others who work in the organization, has it changed? Do you feel like you're in more danger these days?
Oh, yes. For example, I started with United Nations volunteers and CARE in Somalia in 1982, and I would drive for 7 to 8 hours by myself in a four-wheel drive vehicle from Ghetto, which is now a very insecure area, into Mogadishu, which is even less secure. I would do that by myself. I wouldn't attempt to do that now.
At that morning meeting you're talking about, what are some of the kinds of things that, get discussed? I mean, are you talking about security at a certain airstrip or what's been going on in, certain towns?
Well, we first, I guess, talk about the overall situation in the country. There are peace processes going on in each of the countries. We talk a little bit about whether those are advancing or not, what implications that has for the security on the ground. Then we talk more regionally about, you know, what movements we have heard of and so forth. But in the end, it's the people on the ground that call it. Are we going to be able to go out today or not? Hmm. We try and feed into that process and make overall security judgments. But in the end of the day, it's the people on the ground that really have to decide whether they're venturing out of their compound or
what. Yeah. Let's get a caller on the line. Dean is with us from Boise, Idaho.
Yes, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I have served with the military. I'm in the National Guard currently, but I served as a division civil affairs officer in Bosnia last year. And the division civil affairs officer serves as a liaison between the international community and the military, and there's a natural tension there.
Elaborate on that a little bit. What's the tension?
Well, you have military commanders, especially in a situation such as we have in Iraq currently. Their goal is security, obviously, is a major concern in conducting operations, and they oftentimes see the UN employees or non-government organizations as being wild cards on the battlefield that create problems for them. At the same time, we recognize the importance in the long-term stability of the country. And in resolving the issues we're there to deal with, we need the UN and various other organizations there to provide the humanitarian aid, to help recreate the government infrastructure and that type of thing. And so the civil affairs personnel are kind of the liaisons between them. And in the current operations in Iraq, civil affairs has played an extremely important role, and you could see a lot of that in the news coverage, especially with the embedded media.
Yeah. Gordy Molitor, let me ask you that same question from your point of view. Is there tension sometimes with the military?
I've not worked with the military in any of the countries that I've worked with. There haven't been military there, mostly without government. But I would imagine that there is, because the humanitarian agencies will insist on what we would call an impartiality. We don't like to be seen, or we can't be seen, to be favoring any side in a military conflict. I can give you an example of our work in Somalia. I took a recent field trip to Somalia. From Mogadishu, we left the hotel and the office are in the same area, held by one militia group. We had to pass into a second militia group in order to go up to see the port where food was being imported, and then came back into northern Mogadishu and to see the warehouse and the old CARE office before the war. and then pass through another armed checkpoint to go into the third area where we had come from. In order for us to do our work, we had to be seen as impartial by all three of those military units without a very serious command structure. So there had to be a lot of communication and coordination and knowledge of what's going on, and all three of them had to think that, oh, it's CARE. CARE's not on the side of the militia that's just handing these people over to us.
Yeah.
They're impartial. And so I think sometimes the military don't understand that.
Dean?
Well, that is a difficult thing for the U.S. military, of course, so that's where my experience is. In Iraq, for example, right now, after the bombing at the hotel, one of the things that was asked is, where was the security? And, of course, who are they expecting to provide the security? It's typically the U.S. military in the environments where I have some experience. But one of the things that was insisted upon when I was in Bosnia, and I had frequent meetings with representatives from the UNHCR, from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, and the Office of the High Representative, that we would not ride in their vehicles, they would not ride in our vehicles, because we did and we recognized the importance of maintaining that distance. But at the same time, we had to work very, very closely in order to ensure that our mutual objectives were being met. The U.S. military obviously had some different objectives, some other objectives that were not necessarily central to what the aid agencies and the UN agencies were doing, but we tried to cooperate very closely so that we could both achieve our goals there.
And, of course, a lot of people join the U.S. military for many of the same reasons that a lot of people join humanitarian aid organizations, to help people. Dean?
That's true. I'd like to just make one last comment with regard to that, too, is that you're finding that more and more non-government organizations and UN agencies are employing former military personnel, because those military personnel, first of all, have got experience in environments that are tense, such as in Iraq and Bosnia and Kosovo, and they know how to relate to the military when they're working for these organizations. So there's more and more of that occurring.
Dean, thanks very much.
You're welcome, and thank you.
And Gordy Molitor, just before we let you go, would you go into this line of work today if you knew now what you knew then?
Yes, I would. I know that you asked the question earlier. I was listening in, that why people do this. CARE is not only a relief organization, and we do a lot of development work. So we've had a variety of background. But I do this work for three reasons. One, out of a sense of fairness or a sense of justice. Being an American, I think I was born into a place of privilege. And I think it's only fair and just that I help the less privileged in the world have access to their rights. So, I can't think of a better thing to do with my time here on this earth. The other is that it's just a fascinating line of work. The people that you meet and the issues that you discuss, the issue we're discussing today, just the people that I've met in this week, indigenous leaders from southern Sudan, the new American ambassador, the Norwegian head of Operation Lifeline Sudan, and so forth. And the third reason is that it's a sense of adventure. When I lived in North Sudan, in Khartoum, on the other side of the war, we always joke that, well, it's an adventure going to the grocery store, because you never know what to expect. And I've had the opportunity in this line of work to meet indigenous people in the Amazon, Somali nomads in the desert, Dinka nomads in South Sudan. It's an adventure.
Well,
so I do it for fairness, fascination, and adventure.
Gordy Molitor, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your staying up late to be with us. Gordy Molitor is the country director for the relief agency CARE in Somalia and South Sudan. We spoke to him from his home in Nairobi, Kenya. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. The French-based relief organization Médecins Sans Frontières, known in English as Doctors Without Borders, won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1999 for its fearless work in some of the world's most dangerous places. Made up of volunteer doctors from all over the world, Doctors Without Borders has maintained a presence in violence-ridden Liberia for some time. Joining us now from the Liberian capital, Monrovia, is a Doctors Without Borders volunteer, Dr. Andrew Shekman, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. I'm glad to be able to join you.
It's late in the evening now in Monrovia. You spent the day in the hospital. How are the conditions there?
The conditions are better.
We're speaking with Dr. Shekman on a cell phone, and we're having difficulty maintaining communications. There's no landlines available in Monrovia. Dr. Shekman, can you hear me now? And I guess we've lost the line, and we'll try to get Dr. Shekman back. Let's, in the meantime, get a phone call. And Neil's on the line from San Diego. Hello, Neil.
Hello.
I don't get to say that very often, but hi. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, my name is Neil Joyce. I live in Vista right now, but I've done international work in a number of settings. And one of the issues I wanted to talk about was why a physician or an aid worker might want to work in some areas and might not want to go to another area, not in Iraq right now.
Well, elaborate on that.
Well, the situation in Iraq is that the United States has got a primary involvement. We are the cause of much of the chaos there. Clearly, there's a humanitarian emergency going on, and there's a need for aid workers. But if the United States is going to be involved in managing the aid there, and if agencies are going to be working there, need to work closely with the U.S. government, then we've violated the principle of neutrality. It's neutrality that provides security for aid workers. And if we're perceived as being partisan or taking sides, then aid workers aren't safe. Neither is effective aid work being done. Because when an aid worker or humanitarian agency is working in a place but is perceived as taking a side, then he can polarize the environment that he's working in and end up causing more problems in that situation.
Okay, Neil, thank you very much for the call. We're having difficulty with your cell phone, too. I suspect that we're hearing the highway sounds behind you, but thanks very much for the phone call. And we're going to continue taking your calls on this subject. I understand we do have Dr. Shekman back on the line. We're going to talk with him about the situation in Monrovia and about the work of Doctors Without Borders when we come back from a short break. If you'd like to join the conversation again, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Later on in the program, number 5 on the U.S. government's list of most wanted Iraqis is now in custody. We'll talk about the capture of Chemical Ali. That's also on the program after the break. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. In a few moments, we'll turn our attention to the capture of Iraq's infamous Chemical Ali, but now we return to our conversation about international aid workers, and we believe with us on the line now from Monrovia is Dr. Andrew Shekman of Doctors Without Borders, and good of you to be up late with us.
Yeah, I'm glad to be with you.
Again, you spent the day in the hospital there. Can you tell us about conditions?
Yeah, conditions now are a little easier than they were 2 weeks ago when we were under fire with landing mortars and falling bullets. Now we're seeing a lot of medically sick patients coming into the hospital, whereas before it was war injuries. Back during the fighting, the people with cholera, severe malaria, meningitis were left at home by family members who were afraid to go out into the streets to bring them to the hospital. So the character of the patients we're seeing in the hospital has changed by 100% in the past few days.
To do your work effectively, you need, power, light, clean water, and equipment, and of course, medicines. Is that sort of keeping that infrastructure up and going? That must be tremendously difficult.
It is. It's one of the reasons that I've liked working with Doctors Without Borders. It's one of their strengths, I think, is maintaining a good logistic backup for the medical work. A doctor in a country like Monrovia really couldn't do anything without supplies, medicines, sterilization of surgical equipment, and like you said, electricity, clean drinking water, and a livable facility. So there's a lot more to making the work happen than just the doctors.
What motivated you to sign up for this duty?
Well, I thought it would be a big challenge to go somewhere where I was the only doctor and had to deal with whatever came along. I trained in the United States as a family practice doctor and learned to do obstetrics and some surgery and a lot of medicine, pediatrics, sort of broad scope of medicine. And I thought, what better place to put it to practice than a place like Liberia, where a few months ago I was the only doctor for 50,000 internally displaced people in camps in the middle of the country. So it's been incredibly challenging and rewarding.
That could obviously, there's as we've mentioned in other circumstances, there's an element of adrenaline, certainly when there's mortars and bullets ringing out all the time. Does that overcome the fear?
Yeah, it did. I mean, there's one circumstance I'm remembering where we had gotten patients into our emergency room from a recent mortar attack that was landing just outside the hospital, and patients were being carried into the emergency room, you know, by the dozens, and the mortars were coming closer and closer. And at one point, one of the other doctors and I just looked at each other and we said, "We have to get out of here. This is too close." But we were surrounded by patients and we just kept working, and luckily the mortars didn't get closer.
You're a volunteer. How long do you think you're going to continue doing this?
Well, I started working with Doctors Without Borders in 1998. I worked in Uganda on a sleeping sickness project, and then I worked in the United States for a few years, and then have just been in Liberia for the past year now. So it's something I'd like to keep doing intermittently throughout my career. It's a great complement to medicine in the United States.
So you'll go back and maybe start that general practice back home, but do this part-time?
Yeah, it's hard to do part-time. I've found it's easy to do when changing jobs, leaving one place and going to another. But I find when I come and work overseas, I like coming for a good period of 6 months, and this time it's been a year because of the getting to know the people, learning a little bit about the culture in addition to just doing the medical work.
The language must be important, too.
Yeah, it is, and luckily in Liberia they speak English, so it hasn't been too big of a barrier, although I have to admit in the first couple of weeks the accent, with the Liberian accent, I was only catching about 80% of the word.
Just one question left, and we'll let you go get some sleep, but Dr. Shechtman, we've been asking other people working in other organizations what it's been like dealing with various military groups and their liaison. Obviously, Doctors Without Borders, to do its work, must also be perceived as neutral. Obviously, you've had a lot of different military groups go through Monrovia in the past few weeks.
Yes, definitely. Doctors Without Borders often, we prize our impartiality and neutrality, and to enforce it, we make a point of working on both sides of conflicts. So recently, when we've been able to cross the front line, we've We've started beginning some projects in the rebel-held territory of Liberia in addition to our work in the government-held territory. So I think by maintaining a medical presence on both sides of the war, it really cements our neutrality, and it prevents us from being hit by either side.
Dr. Shechtman, thanks very much for being with us tonight. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Andrew Shechtman is a volunteer with Doctors Without Borders. He's been providing medical care in the Liberian capital of Monrovia for the past several months, and he spoke with us from there.